You know, in the olden days, they would take the grinding machine. There would be some stones that would grind, you know, the wheat. And there would be a stone on top and a stone below. And they would all be circular in shape. The stone on top would have a stick connected to it, like a pole connected to it. And that pole would be connected to an animal, like a donkey. And then they would close the eyes of the donkey and they would make the donkey walk. They would drive the donkey. And the donkey would continuously walk in circles. And as the donkey would walk in circles, he would push the pole, and the pole would turn the rock that was on top, the rock that was lying on top of the other rock. And as it would turn, it would cause a grinding effect to happen, and therefore they would make flour in that way. So Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the one who worships without thinking is like this donkey who is used to turn around the pivot of this grinding machine.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about this group called the Mariqeen or the Khawarij. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, he compares these people to a donkey that is whose eyes are closed, and whose eyes have been closed by a cloth, let's say, and is just turning around in circles, trying to push that grinding machine, as I explained in the previous segment. Now, this poor donkey, right, if he would be left to walk in a straight line, he would have probably traversed from Medina, let's say, in Arabia, passed by Iraq, and you know all the cities there, and into Baghdad and Samarkand, into Iran, and maybe would have reached China. But poor guy, because his eyes have been closed and he's walking around in circles, when the animal is stopped after 6 months and the cloth is open from his eyes, he realizes that he has returned back to square one and he has not gone forward. Why? Because he's a person who is worshipping, who is moving. He thinks he's moving, but he's moving around in circles because he doesn't have insight. He doesn't see ahead. But instead, if there's a person who has got insight and knowledge, a person who, when he wants to worship and become submissive to a certain, ideology, he gives it thought, understanding, he goes into it with insight and research and firmly accepts that methodology and that teaching and that religion with his intellect, then that one is like a man, or like a horse who knows his direction and is firm in reaching that direction. And it goes so fast and reaches that direction. That is why we need to be very careful that whenever we want to accept a certain ideology or a thinking, then we need to really give it thought and understanding before taking rash steps. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a white flower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran. Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding. The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north. This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction. In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic birds from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 birds of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella birds, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the birds over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for birds and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from the hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bears' living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
a group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rock hopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أول عوض الحليم من حلمه أن الناس أنصاره على الجاهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "The first reward the exerciser of forbearance gets is that people become his helpers against the ignorant."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. In the traditions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this concept of the heart. Now, in many traditions, we find that the heart is considered the place where Allah resides. And we also find that the heart is the place where the love for Allah exists. Now, we find, again, in the traditions and in the Holy Quran in general, that we must protect this heart. And of course, when it comes to the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this perfect heart, this heart which has reached a kamal, a perfection, a completion, a completeness which leads towards ultimate perfection. Now, this heart, again, it must be protected. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when talking about this heart, he says that if despair, hopelessness, al-yas, overtakes the heart, successive regrets will kill it, and the anger of the heart will be intensified. And so here, dear brothers, we find that this is the truth, right? Well, one of the greatest sins, and of course in the book Greater Sins by Ayatollah Dastaghayb Shirazi, we find that he speaks about despair being one of the greater sins. Now, despairing in the mercy of Allah, despairing in the help of Allah, despairing in the victory of Allah. So in general, it means that we believe or we imagine that the troubles and tribulations and problems and hardships that we face in life are so great that even Allah either can't help us or He won't help us. And in both cases, we end up despairing from the help of Allah, the victory of Allah, the mercy of Allah, the forgiveness of Allah. Now, when this despair overtakes our heart, Imam Ali says, successive regrets will kill it. Right? So the first step in this road towards destruction and ruin and depression and anguish and anger and frustration and regret and all these negative emotions, the first step is despair. We cannot save ourselves. Allah will not save us. Allah cannot save us. Allah will not forgive us. Allah will not find us a solution to our problems. And what happens is that then successive regrets come. Well, why didn't Allah help me? Allah should have helped me. This didn't happen. That didn't happen. This didn't get accomplished. That didn't get accomplished. This negative regret continuously, because it stems upon despair, starts to kill the heart. And eventually, the heart becomes so filled with despair and regret over the past and even perhaps the present that it is overwhelmed with anger, and anger is a constant companion for a human being. And it's not really a companion. More than a companion, it's a constant torment for a human being. For as it is also related in the traditions, the anger hurts the individual themselves more than it hurts anybody else. And so, in order to protect this heart and make sure that it remains the abode of the Almighty Allah and that the love for Allah increases one way or the other, as Imam Ali says, do not let despair overtake your heart. Do not let successive regrets kill your heart. And of course, do not inflame and ruin your heart via anger. Another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Do you want to be healthy and feel good? Perhaps you won't find anyone not sharing this goal. Whilst there's a plethora of advice online and by experts, we have wonderful recommendations in Islamic teachings, including the sayings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. They all lived a healthy life and would love their followers to be healthy too. For instance, I have personally found hundreds of narrations on healthy lifestyle from the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi as-salam. Here are tips in this regard. The art of eating. In advice to his son, Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, states, "Do not eat unless you're hungry. Leave eating whilst you're still hungry and chew the food very well." Number 5, do not overeat. Overeating causes illness. Excessive eating corrupts the soul. Be wary of eating too much, for it darkens the heart. These are some of the narrations from Imam alayhi salam highlighting the dangers of excessive consumption of food. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we lose self-control or feel pressure to eat. Even those may be situations where we may not be hungry. For example, we find ourselves when we have to eat from buffets or when we go from one invitation to another. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam once again links food consumption to the health of one's soul, the nafs, and highlights how the path of spirituality is illuminated with moderation and avoidance of excessiveness. In the book Ghurar al-Hikam, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, "If you reduce how much you eat, your intellectual ability will enhance." Number 6, the night worship. At first glance, you might be thinking, how is this linked to a healthy lifestyle? Well, in a number of traditions, it is reported that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, to stay up at night worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about health for the body, pleasure of the Lord, adherence to the ways of the prophets, and pouring of God's mercy. This is probably mainly linked to praying the night prayer, Salatul Layl, which can be prayed any time at night, but preferably after midnight.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars and ulama of the 13th century Hijra, originally from India. He is Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, but mainly known as Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, the author of the magnum opus Abaghatul Anwar. We try to first take a look at his early life and then at his most outstanding book, that is Abaghat al-Anwar. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you. Give us some information about the early life of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Allama Sayyid Mehdi Abu Zafar, or Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, was born in 1246 according to lunar calendar in a village close to the Delhi, capital city of India. And as his name is showing, he was from Sadat. He was from the offspring of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he is named as his grandfather Hamed Hussein. And when we want to trace back his lineage, he goes back to the children of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wasallam, mm-hmm. the seventh Imam of Shia, with 27 means and I mean generations.
Generations, okay.
Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi started his Islamic teachings and Islamic studies when he was 6 years old. And he studied with different teachers, but mainly at the beginning of his studying, his father was the teacher that brought him up according to Islamic school of thought. And when he was 14, he came to study theology and some way finishing fiqh. He studied Islamic jurisprudence with the Sultan al-Ulama, Sayyid Muhammad bin Dildar Ali, mm-hmm. and also with the brother of his teacher, Sayyid al-Ulama, Sayyid Hussein bin Dildar Ali. Both of them were the scholars in India. Right. And you know, some of maybe these scholars are not well known to mm-hmm. the rest of Islamic world,
yes.
but they were well known at that time in India.
That's right.
And also he wrote a book, we should say a commentary, yes. and the book of Manahij al-Tadqiq that was written by his teacher,
right.
Sayyid al-Ulama. And also he corrected and also tried to publish some of the works of his father.
That's right.
Like Futuhat Haydariye, Risale Taqiyye, Tashid al-Mata'in. And when he moved to Hajj, he traveled to perform the pilgrimage of Hajj, and also went to Atawat Aliyat, to Karbala, Najaf, and Samarra, and Kazimain. And then he came back to India, and from that moment on, his life is, you know, more brilliant for us, of course.
Okay.
And we have more information regarding this period of his life.
We studied the life account of Mir Hamed Hussein Hendi, and compare it with the other scholars of the Shia studies, we find him from India, something which is very much rare, because most of the scholars were either from Iran, Persia, or Iraq, Lebanon, you know. This man is from India. My point is this. He writes a book which becomes one of the most outstanding, you know, books in defense of the Shiism and the Shia beliefs. That is Abaghat al-Anwar. First of all, let's talk about the main intention of Mir Hamed Hussein Hendi to compile such a book. What was the main goal, Sheikh Mahdavi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That is a good point. I may respond this way, that his main intention is loyalty to the actually school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and to defend from the truth. Because in his area, I mean, since he's originally from India, we know that the actually population of Muslim there, I mean, Sunni brothers outnumbered Shia over there. So definitely they are going to have more scholars because of the facilities that they have there. But we see over there one book is being published entitled Tuhfatu Ithna Ashariya. When we look at the title of this book, we see it has been actually written in a kind of downgrading Shia sect. That is not the approach of all Sunnis. They do not treat Shias like this. I mean, to entitle your book in a way that it is kind of mockery or making fun of the thing. So Tuhfat Ithna Ashariya means the present or the gift of Ithna Ashariya. So 12 words. So let's look at this gift. And then he, in his book, he's trying to reject
Shiism. A person by the name of Abdul Aziz al-Dihlawi.
Yes, this book
has authored this book in rejection of the Shia beliefs. So you want to say that Abaghat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimmat al-Adhar was written as a rebuttal or an answer.
Yes, that was a rebuttal book. But before we get into this book, we have to know that at this, at its time, that book, I mean the book which had been produced by that Sunni author, was a good and strong book in a way that it was circulating among Shia scholars, but they wouldn't prepare a good response for that. By that moment, late Sayyid Mir Hamed Hussein, he comes to this point that he has to benefit from all knowledge that he has gained through all those years.
That's right.
So he will produce a book which right now we can see that book in 10 volumes, although there are other records being 30 volumes or even 100 volumes, but what right now we have at hand is including 10 volumes, and the way he approached that Sunni book is regarded as a kind of very technical and respectful, because it is easy to refute something using words which are not appropriated for the field of actually scholarly feed, or it is not appropriating the academic area. But when we look at his work, we see that the way he is approaching all things in his book is really, really professional.
That's right.
And this is because of the author, because he is regarded as one of the prolific authors.
That's right.
He knew many things about the Quran. He knew many things about the Riwayat. So he divides his book into two parts. First part, he actually approaches all verses that have been employed in the Sunni book in order to reject the idea of Shiism.
That's right.
So one by one, he will take all verses that some of which are really familiar for our listeners, like Innama waliyakumullah wa rasuluhu, or the other verse Al Yawm Akmaltu Lakum Dinakum, and the other verse that our listeners are familiar with.
So he takes all these verses one after another and he tries to actually refute the argument of the author in a way that, okay, Shi'ism had been and is being proven through these verses. And then he gets into the actually field of the riwayat.
So more than Shi'ism, I think it is about the concept of imamat, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
That's because, which is the main pillar of the Shia belief. And so maybe so many people from our Muslim brethren believe that there is no direct reference to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran, but Mir Hamad Hussein and so many other scholars have proven that there are direct incidents and events mentioned in the Holy Quran through the ayahs of the Holy Quran that show the authenticity of the concept of imamate and the leadership and the successorship. This is a specialized field of study. I mean, maybe by mere studying the text of the Holy Quran, some people might not understand it. But if we get to the shan and nuzul of the ayat and the different incidents, and we have to know Arabic language, of course, and the exegesis of the Holy Quran, then we could understand that. That's right. Some references are made to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran too. That's all right. So he wrote it in Farsi language, And I think it is because the Farsi language was the mother tongue of that region, of the Indian subcontinent, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the Indian subcontinent.
Even we have Iqbal-e-Lahuri.
Iqbal-e-Lahuri writes in
composing
Farsi.
Composing poets in
Farsi. Poets in Farsi language, that's right. Yeah. Okay, that's all right. Sheikh Ziyaniyal, let's get to you, brother. What information can you give us about Abaghat al-Anwar and the significance of this book? I mean, what is the high position of this book in the Shia library? Why is it so important?
As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdavi, mentioned, this book is written according to the book of Tuhfa Ithna al-Sharia. And because that book was Persian, this book is also Persian.
You mean as an answer to that book?
That's yes. Right.
Okay.
And Tuhfa Ithna al-Sharia is consisted of 12 chapters. And each chapter is talking about proper aspect of Shia school of thought. For example, first chapter is talking about the history of Shia school of thought and gives accusations regarding Shia school of thought.
That's right.
And most important part of the book is chapter 7 that is regarding imamat.
Imamat, that's right.
And Abaghat al-Anwar and many other books, this is not the only Abaghat, some other books also are written in this regard. They are trying to defend the Shia school of thought regarding the subject of imamat. And you know why? Because when the subject of imamat is proved and is accepted, then all these discussions should be put on the shelves. Because the milestone and the root of every discussion in the theology of Islam between the denominations is the topic of imamat.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the Holy Prophet's demise, we see that some of the Muslims, they try to say that, okay, the Holy Prophet did not appoint anyone. And some of Muslims, they would say that, no, Prophet appointed a person as his caliph and introduced Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam. So if this discussion is solved, then the coming discussions that they are after this, they must be, all of them are put aside.
That's right.
And there's no negotiation anymore.
Okay.
Yes, I believe in this, you believe in that.
Yes.
No problem, but we should understand each other's, reasoning.
That's right.
Why Abaghat is putting emphasis on this point.
That's right.
I mean, imamat.
Yes.
Because this is the most basic difference between Shia school of thought and Sunni school
and
of
the
thought.
The beliefs, that's right. How is his style of writing or compilation?
Yeah. Of course, because this book is trying to answer the problems that are raised by the book of Tuhfa Ithna al-Sharia, so it's obvious that this book is going through the subject of that book, the first one, I mean Tuhfa Ithna al-Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
But Abaghat al-Anwar itself have this manner that at the beginning, when it's about riwayat, it's trying to give the sources of riwayat and then tries to give the chain of narrators and then try to convey a research on these chain of narrators who are these people?
That's right.
Are they authentic or not? And he proves that these are authentic.
That's right.
And then after approving this point that the chain of narrator is authentic and is accepted by all, so then he goes to the dilalah and the argumentation that's based right. on the text of riwayat.
Text of the riwayat. That's
so he tries to say, okay, this riwayat is a proof for the school of thought of Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
So in this way, alhamdulillah, both sides are covered.
That's
I mean,
right.
the sanad, mm-hmm. I mean, the tracing back the riwayat to Ahlul Bayt, to yes. the Holy Prophet.
Yes.
And then secondly, the dilalat or the reasoning that is derived okay. from the text.
Because the Shiism was accused that some of these narrations are not authentic
or
does not
fake,
have
yeah.
enough wusukh. So Amir Hamad Hussein Hendi shows that they are authentic, even maybe based on the Sunni references
yeah, for
too.
Sure.
And this is the great, we can say, point.
And another important point regarding this book is that many of the subjects of the book is taken from the Sunni sources.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a Shia-based book
Shia-based
to answer
book.
The problems from own point of view,
okay.
but he tries to give evidences from Sunni books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important point regarding this book
that's right.
that have made it, you know, famous.
Okay. And it was acknowledged by so many outstanding, high-quality asatid professors and scholars of the Shia world, Sheikh Matavi, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. And among them, we may name Allama Amini, who is the author of yes. Al-Ghadir. He
yes.
himself has authored a book in favor or in defense of
yes.
Shiism.
Yes.
Actually, giving this focus on the hadith of Al-Ghadir and the incident and event of Al-Ghadir Khum.
Yes.
But he himself, when it comes to the point to acknowledge the book of Abaqat, he is saying very noble words and exalting this work of Marhum Mir Hamad Hussein, saying
right.
that the nice smell of this book
mm-hmm.
has spread all world from the west to the east.
Mm-hmm.
So someone like Allama Amini, who has authored a book
yes.
regarding the Imamat, is acknowledging the book of Abaqat. Again, we see Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani. He himself
yes.
is considered as one of the great and outstanding codicologists
yes.
who have compiled the name of more than 50,000 books in his compilation, which is called Al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shi'a. In his book, again, he is acknowledging Abaqat al-Anwar. So having this understanding about the all works
yes.
from the Shia authors, he comes to this point to again acknowledge and admire the work that the author of Abaqat has conducted. So it's
okay.
really a good work, and this is not except for his purity, his
yes.
hard working, as it is said in the memories and stories that happened for him. They're saying that even the time his son passed away, not more than 1 hour he dedicated for the funeral thing, and the rest of the works and efforts he left it in the hands
even
of the relatives.
His eyesight and his right hand for writing.
Yes,
you know,
so it says
right.
he
okay.
was a really
yes.
prolific, non-stop writing
yes.
author
yes.
who dedicated his whole life to defend from the actually school
right.
of Ahlul Bayt. May Allah bless him.
May Allah bless him. That's why he was really admired by so many outstanding other scholars like Mirza Shirazi, as you said. We can say Sheikh Zainuddin Mazandarani and also Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi, who write in admiration of Abaqat al-Anwar in defense of the Shia beliefs. Safar 18, 1306, according to the Hijra calendar, is the day in which he passed away, and his body was taken to a Husainia known as Jinab Qufran Ma'ab. He passed away with them, buried over there, and a commemoration session and gathering was held for him in Iraq. In Atabat. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Amin Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, mainly known as Mir Hamad Hussein Hendi, known by his book Abaqat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimat al-Athar. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanullah.
Mu'allim. the Congo, treasure island in the heart of Africa.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its East rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes.